Good morning. Terrific to be with you. Thank you to Simon and the ABA for the invitation. The international financial system has operated downstream from the larger system of international order ever since the modern state system emerged in Europe 4 centuries ago. Each time this order has gone through a major realignment, it's had profound consequences. While for much of the past generation, financial system participants might have safely relegated geopolitics to the history books, the issues at hand are no longer just of historical interest. Rather, they are compelling policymakers to step up efforts to ensure their financial systems can operate through a much more perilous risk environment. As I'll set out today, in Australia, this has been a central focus of the Council of Financial Regulators for some years. A more strained geopolitical environment could have first-order implications for the financial system in various ways, relating to the resilience of critical payments infrastructure, threats to key institutions posed by disinformation campaigns and insider and foreign interference, the fragmentation of cross-border capital flows under the shadow of asset seizures, increasingly sophisticated sanctions evasion techniques, and public-private coordination challenges. So my punchline today is simple. It is in our collective interest to prepare for a financial system that is more shock-prone in the future. Now, contextualising our current predicament requires some historical context. After decades riven by conflict, the Peace of Westphalia in 1648 sought to stabilise European affairs by imposing a set of neutral rules and norms to regulate the conduct of leading states. But it failed to deliver peace, and the global economy and the global financial system remained fragmented. The Concert of Europe system that ran for a century up until 1913, that emerged from the Napoleonic Wars, was more fruitful. A collective mechanism for stability overseen by leading states provided the foundation for the first modern era of globalisation. Capital and goods flowed across borders like never before. A truly international financial system was born. But by the early 20th century, tectonic plates were again moving in an ominous direction, territorial disputes were escalating, and an arms race was fueled by mercantilist industrial policies. The catastrophe of the First World War, followed by a global financial crisis and world depression, plunged the world into a more virulent strain of protectionism and extremism. But from the convulsion of the Second World War, a unique international order emerged. The San Francisco Accords and the Bretton Woods Agreement ushered in an era of unprecedented international stability and prosperity. States large and small opted to forego the short-term zero-sum gains in favour of the long-term benefits of mutual cooperation. And so even in the shadow of the Cold War, international financial and economic integration scaled new heights, and it seemed almost everyone had skin in the game. Now, a common perspective forged from the benign geopolitical environment of the post-Cold War period was that geopolitics no really mattered for the financial system. The low risk premiums observed in recent years across global markets are perhaps just the latest example. I would, however, urge caution with this interpretation. Some of the most consequential developments in the global financial system across markets, payments, and institutions were the product of geopolitical upheaval. For a start, geopolitical shocks have had a history of severely disrupting financial markets. The outbreak of the First World War came as such a shock that the US and London exchanges were shut for 4 and 5 months respectively. Bond and stock prices were severely hit then through both world wars, and it took years for the bond and stock markets to recover from the 1970s Middle East energy shocks that followed the Vietnam War. In addition, geopolitical risk is long featured in contingency planning for the payment system, an issue I'll return to later. When the risk of nuclear war between NATO and Warsaw Pact members was most grave, the Bundesbank stashed 15 billion marks in a top secret underground bunker in a small regional town in Germany. Today it serves as a public museum. Other countries made similar contingency arrangements. And from grave geopolitical shocks, a number of leading financial institutions were born, including a number of central banks and, of course, the International Monetary Fund. But as the end of the Cold War ushered in the era of the peace dividend and Francis Fukuyama declared the end of history, strategic concerns largely fell off the radar for a generation of economists and financial market participants. This unusually benign environment had profound implications for international commerce. In lowering the need for insurance, industry could get on with the job of maximising efficiency with scant regard for the resilience demanded of earlier friction-prone eras. Capital moved seamlessly around the world. Financial and economic independence became a feature, not a bug, of the international system. The lessons of the 1930s had been learnt, and hedging against geopolitical risk barely had to enter the equation. Not everyone was convinced, however. Foreign policy analysts schooled in the realist tradition warned that in a world where no country could be entirely sure of its security, large shifts in the distribution of power, economic and military, had historically been associated with significant instability. And indeed, for a number of years now, challenges to international cohesion have emerged. Financial and economic linkages are again being reshaped by strategic considerations. Some indicators suggest a fracturing is occurring on a scale and with a speed unseen in decades. What is clear is that strategic uncertainty and a significant shift in the distribution of power is prompting countries to revisit their security posture. Military spending is rising to levels last seen in the Cold War. This is reprising the question Robert Jervis famously posed half a century ago over the security dilemma. That is, in a world of fraying trust and uncertain intentions, how might countries make themselves more secure without those efforts prompting insecurity in others? The sense of certainty that pervaded international affairs following the end of the Cold War and that greased the wheels of global finance and trade has perhaps been the first casualty. Of particular relevance to this audience, leading international relations scholars started to query whether finance and technology might emerge as the key focal points of strategic competition in the age of nuclear deterrence. The fact there'd been no hot wars among the great powers for decades has given this concept of an alternative battle space additional impetus, as has the fact that finance and technology have become the epicenter of grey zone activity. As our security agencies have emphasised, coercion is increasingly occurring just below the threshold of conflict, and cyber operations have become a tool of modern statecraft. Beginning with the cyber attacks unleashed on the banking systems of Estonia in 2007 and the United States in 2012. Fears over the pre-positioning of malware and critical systems continue to grow, and rapid advances in AI and quantum computing are only adding to the challenges. All of this brings us to the old aphorism: we must take the world as it is, not as we wish it to be. Let me now turn to the issue of geopolitical fragmentation. The issue of whether a more contested strategic environment could see the international financial system fragment along geopolitical lines has been an area of growing focus. My overall reading is that fragmentation is unfolding in some respects, less so in others. It very much depends on the context. I'd make two general points. First, the shape of the global financial system is always evolving in response to changes in technology and the composition of global growth. We should therefore resist the temptation to view every sign of change as evidence of a fragmenting system. Second, the extent to which fragmentation might either amplify global shocks or help countries to absorb them is highly context dependent. A more siloed system might weaken the global financial safety net and international coordination mechanisms when financial crises hit. And at the same time, a deteriorating strategic environment is understandably prompting renewed focus on the role for self-insurance. How countries and industry get the balance right here is a complex question. Let me now turn to some of the evidence for and against fragmentation. Trends in foreign direct investment offer perhaps one of the more visible indications of global financial fragmentation. Countries that are geopolitically aligned are engaging in above average flows of foreign direct investment. The opposite is true for countries that are geopolitically distant. The longer term orientation of FDI and the relatively higher costs of a disorderly exit mean that geopolitical uncertainty is more salient for FDI than for portfolio flows or bank lending. This is also consistent with the emerging evidence of trade fragmentation, which was a trend that also characterized the Cold War. What about capital flows between the US and China? Here, there's been a shift in pace, if not direction. Capital flows from the US to China have slowed to a crawl in recent years. In the other direction, a literal reading of China's balance sheet points to outflows from the United States in recent years in favor of emerging market exposures, but the role of custodians outside of the US clouds the picture as to how large these outflows from the US have been in reality. On the narrower topic of reserve asset holdings, recent developments point more to continuity than to rupture. Trends that have been in place for two decades, such as an increase in emerging market central bank purchases of gold and a gradually lower share of the US dollar in the currency mix of reserve portfolios, have largely continued. But reports of the demise of the US dollar have been exaggerated. It's still used in 90% of all foreign exchange transactions. It remains the dominant currency in reserve portfolios and is the beneficiary of dollar-based trade invoicing. For as long as the world pays in dollars, it will likely save in dollars. Notwithstanding the renewed momentum in China to internationalize the renminbi, its share in global reserve holdings has edged lower in recent years to just 2%. Cross-border payments have increasingly come into focus in discussions over whether the financial system is fragmenting. In recent years, some emerging market countries have developed cross-border capabilities that sit outside of traditional rails. Anecdotal reports, though, point to limited uptake in countries like Russia and Iran. But in China, volumes transmitted through the cross-border interbank payment system, which has been clearing and settling transactions in renminbi for more than a decade, have grown notably. Energy-related transactions are reportedly accounting for some of this. And at the same time that the renminbi share of SWIFT messages has declined, volumes over the new Enbridge platform, which involves a limited set of countries, are reported to have increased sharply from around 20 million a few years ago to 55 billion by late last year. Now, where all these cross-border payment developments go remains to be seen, but I can make two points. First, the SWIFT messaging architecture remains the backbone for cross-border payments. And second, it's essential that the high standards of security and integrity are maintained in cross-border payments. And the engagement of the RBA in various cross-border initiatives speaks to this, as does the strengthening of digital asset regimes in many jurisdictions to support responsible innovation in tokenized money. A quick word about sanctions. Since the times of ancient Greece, sanctions have been an instrument of statecraft. Those imposed by the United Nations Security Council are legally binding under international law. While sanctions increased steadily at the global level in the decades after the Second World War, over the past decade or so, a number of new trends have emerged which require a new level of compliance capability from financial institutions. Sanctions are being imposed on and by a larger number of states. More than 120 countries were subject to financial sanctions in 2023, twice the number of a decade ago, and a higher figure than for trade sanctions. And more than 70 countries across every major geographical bloc now impose sanctions outside of the formal United Nations process. Critically, targeted entities are using more sophisticated strategies to evade sanctions. And all of this is making financial institutions increasingly exposed to significant legal and business risk if they get it wrong. Let me now drill into some risk implications for the financial industry. There's no universal definition of geopolitical risk, but intuitively, it captures the threat or realization of adverse international political events that involve at least some element of coercion. These possibilities exist along a continuum, from coercive trade bans to hostile state actions below the threshold of conflict, like state-sponsored cyber attacks, up to kinetic shocks in extreme cases. They can be slow or fast moving. As my colleagues recently set out, the resulting implications for the financial system can be wide ranging. Critically, geopolitical risk has broader dimensions than traditional financial risks like credit, market, and liquidity. And while financial risks are always in focus, these are familiar terrain for industry. For Australian banks, the composition of international asset exposures is somewhat less problematic compared to some other countries, and the reliance on external funding, while notable, has declined over the years. I should caution, however, it does not follow that the traditional financial risks have gone away. The high foreign ownership share of our fixed income markets means the Australian financial system will not be immune from shocks abroad. And of course, half of the assets of our super fund industry are invested offshore. Where we see boards and executives increasingly exercised is in the management of less familiar non-financial risks that in periods of geopolitical stress could cut across the financial system in complex and novel ways. These have operational, security, political, and organisational capacity dimensions. They include threats to critical infrastructure, both digital and physical, on which the financial system relies. Risks associated with disinformation and cognitive influence strategies aimed at undermining trust in key institutions. Foreign interference and insider risk. The risk of asset expropriation. Challenges in the surge capacity to ensure compliance with sanctions and counter-sanctions as evasion techniques become more sophisticated. And coordination failure across industry and official sector agencies in a polycrisis scenario if multiple risks were to crystallise simultaneously. And so in recognition of these challenges, the CFR has pursued a program of work to help ensure the financial system is capable of weathering extreme but plausible shocks. Our industry engagement has been informed by extensive consultation with domestic security agencies and peer institutions abroad. Its relevance is underscored by Australia's status as an open economy with strong ties to the international financial system. We've also been mindful that the issues at hand extend well beyond the remit of any individual institution, public or private. Now, in recognising that different elements of our financial system have different responsibilities and obligations, let me draw out some themes and lessons that should be relevant to a wide audience. First, financial institutions are elevating geopolitical considerations to the top of their strategic risks and devoting resources accordingly. This is not just an issue for the most internationally active institutions, nor is it simply an issue for risk executives. Boards have to engage much more intensively. This includes by ensuring the different dimensions of geopolitical risk appropriately embedded in organisational risk appetite and related controls. And more institutions are also standing up dedicated geopolitical risk teams to strengthen accountability and coordination efforts, recognising that issues can cut across organisational silos. Second, efforts to strengthen crisis preparedness and recoverability planning are dialling up significantly. Institutions are hardening their operational perimeters, and more advanced institutions are investing in a wider range of early warning capabilities, including more active monitoring of disinformation. Defensive AI capabilities have also become a core pillar of resilience planning. All of this is requiring a substantial uplift in strategic investment, workforce capability, and integration across security operations. As part of these efforts, crisis and contingency plans are also being developed for a wider range of extreme but increasingly plausible geopolitical scenarios. Playbooks and fire drills are becoming more expansive, involving dedicated strategies for operational recoverability, workforce safety, and crisis communications. We see this in industry exercises ranging from disruptions to subsea cables to sustained outages of the electricity grid. Now, let me say a few words here about payments. It's critical that contingency planning efforts are directed at maintaining a minimum level of service provision in periods of stress. This is the focus of the Industry Resilience Initiative, the IRI, for the payment system that's been overseen by the RBA and APRA, and is also captured in APRA's broader operational risk standard, CPS 230. I should note here that similar efforts are underway internationally. The remarkable stability of the Ukrainian payment system through the maelstrom of war has shown how innovation can bolster resilience in the most perilous of environments, and our Scandinavian colleagues are on a similar journey. Now, the aim of the IRI is to ensure our payment system can maintain continuity of service in the event that a major institution goes dark for a period of time. It's involved the setting of clear resilience objectives, defined triggers and thresholds to guide responses, an industry-wide playbook, technical solutions to enable payments continuity, and a scenario testing framework. At the industry level, the program is being coordinated by AusPayNet with participation by AP Plus, Cuscal, and the major banks. And I'd encourage any institution that would like to know more to reach out to AusPayNet. And under APRA's CPS 230 standard, operational risk, business continuity, and third-party risk are all paramount. And importantly, the latter extends to critical infrastructure and service provision originating from outside of the financial system. A third area of growing attention relates to the increased focus on foreign interference and insider risks. This is resulting in stronger vetting processes, including at very senior levels, a tightening in access to sensitive information, increased demand for security clearances, and the use of sophisticated behavioural analytics to manage threats. A fourth area of focus is requiring industry to build capability to deal more fulsomely with international political risk in the form of sanctions, but also threats to offshore personnel and asset holdings. Now, sanctions and counter-sanctions give rise to a host of risks for financial institutions, legal, reputational, operational, and strategic. Despite Russia being a relatively minor exposure for most financial institutions, Russia's invasion of Ukraine offered a glimpse into the challenges here, from difficulties in international harmonisation, difficulties in administrative surge capacity for specialised functions in a crisis, and challenges associated with sanctions evasion. Discussions with industry suggest that if they have any doubt over their compliance, they will err on the side of pulling back from activity, a collective response that could risk becoming disorderly in extreme scenarios. And so the broader lesson for industry here is that it would be prudent to move beyond viewing the imposition of sanctions as an episodic risk to be managed in the moment, and more as a structural feature of the operating environment that warrants a different level of preparedness. So let me conclude here. For many decades, the major risks to financial stability were thought to be cyclical, generated within the financial system, and their mitigation and resolution involved familiar toolkits. By contrast, the issues I have set out today are structural, originating from outside the financial system, and cut across the financial system in multifaceted ways that require fresh thinking. If finance and technology are emerging as the epicentres of a more contested strategic environment, it will call for a more holistic approach to risk management. Our work with industry suggests some progress has been made, but that progress has been uneven, and there is much still to do. There needs to be contingency planning under more extreme scenarios, more demanding fire drills, more intrusive interrogation of third-party dependencies, and more robust continuity and recoverability arrangements. My colleagues and I at the RBA and on the Council of Financial Regulators are committed to working constructively with industry to ensure our financial system can withstand a more shock-prone future. But time is of the essence, and Australians are depending on all of us here to get it right. Thank you.
Firstly, it's a real pleasure to be presenting this Q&A with you, because I've seen firsthand so much of the work you have been doing to address the issues that you've spoken about today in payments, innovation and beyond. And I completely agree with that clear message that these are really important issues to identify, understand and effectively manage. We're seeing those issues in practice every day at the moment. And the historical context is really important as well to understand both the present and the collective efforts that we need to face this uncertain future together. Reminds me a bit of Churchill. The longer you can look back, the farther you can look forward. So with that, a few questions, if I may. Just to pick up where you ended, how has the rise of geopolitical and operational risk changed how industry should be thinking about the risk to their operations and financial instability more generally?
I think there's probably three significant differences. The first is these risks transcend neat risk buckets and neat organisational silos. They don't respect silos. They cut across institutions, and in fact, the issues actually cut across the economy and society in really complex ways, and that brings to the fore some pretty significant coordination challenges, so that's the first. The second is they potentially give rise to the possibility of multiple shocks occurring simultaneously and with great speed and ferocity. And I think the third is they really behoove us all to think much more deeply about dependencies, including the dependencies we have on infrastructure that sits on or outside the perimeter of the financial system, mm-hmm. which is not a mode of thinking that many of us have really had to lean into up until relatively recently.
That makes sense. And on those dependencies outside of the individual banks in the room, you focused quite a bit of time on the importance of payment system or our payment system being robust to disruptions domestically and internationally. Can you expand on that a bit?
Yeah, this has been a major focus for the Payments System Board for quite some time now, as indeed it is for the Council of Financial Regulators. Payments are the lifeblood of the Australian economy. just to give you some sense of orders of magnitude, we have more than $300 billion each day just going across our rails at the RBA. And so the IRI, the Industry Resilience Initiative, is critically important to ensuring that our payment system is able to maintain continuity of service across a range of stress events. There are big coordination challenges here because, as those who work in the industry well know, it's a very diverse ecosystem. The different set of challenges for retail payments vis-a-vis wholesale payments and also physical cash distribution. So it's a vast area, but we have been leaning into this space pretty hard and will continue to do so. We very much encourage industry to join us on that journey. We also know that from the country's experience with national disasters, that disruptions to the payment system can very quickly mutate from just being an issue for the financial system to having much broader implications for social cohesion. And so this is really a very important piece of work.
And those volumes are remarkable, as you say, across RITs, across the SWIFT messaging system, as well as international payments through CLS. So they really warrant consideration. So then when we think internationally, how do you think the Australian financial system is positioned compared to others internationally to absorb these types of shocks you've been speaking about?
I guess I could begin by echoing a point that John made, which is the initial conditions in the Australian financial system are strong. That's important to recognise. There's a but coming. The but is the nature of the external environment, the rate of deterioration in the external environment is such that there really is no room for complacency. And so that's why I think that's really the subtext to my remarks today and John's earlier this morning. I think there's some areas where Australia is on or very close to the frontier in terms of resilience, and there's some other areas where we're not quite there. I think the really important point to recognise here is our system is only as strong as the weakest link. The financial system almost uniquely hangs together by trust and confidence. And so it's important not just to have the very largest institutions highly resilient, but we need to, over time, shrink the gap between the most and least resilient. And that's a very important message that I and my colleagues on the CFR would like to, you know, industry to hear.
And trust takes a long time to build. Very easy for it to be lost quickly, and we have such volatile markets at the moment. You've spoken a lot about innovation and resilience being able to coexist in our markets. How do you think about those concepts of the interaction between innovation and resilience in this context that we're talking about?
Yeah, look, clearly the world's a scary place, but the solution is not for us to all hide under a rock. I think historically there has been a bit of a tendency to think about there being a trade-off between resilience and innovation. I'm less convinced of that. Actually, I think innovation is foundational and critical to our ability to maintain resilience for the foreseeable future. You'd almost think about it like the old Venn diagram, the space in the middle where innovation can reinforce resilience is a space where I and my colleagues are very interested in exploring and working with industry. We see this in areas in the payment system. The development of new functionality under the IRI is helping to make our system more resilient. We see it in the types of defensive AI capabilities that are being developed. We see it in the types of behavioural analytical techniques that are being used to spot insider threats. So the solution here really is to fight fire with fire and to not recoil at all from innovating. I would maybe just finish on this note. I think it, in the relatively frictionless world of recent decades, industry tended to compete overwhelmingly on efficiency. The world that I've sort of sketched out today and that we heard from John this morning, I think speaks to an opportunity where industry can compete on resilience going forward. I think the value that not just regulators, but in fact, Australians will place on having strong resilience infrastructure, strong resilient capabilities, is going to be paramount, and over time may well be, industry may well view that type of resilience as a source of comparative advantage as distinct from it just being a cost that gets in the way.
As you say, that balance between now efficiency, security, resilience, that'll be really interesting for each institution here to deal with. So I think we're conscious of time. Thank you very much to Dr. Brad Jones for your comments today. We really appreciate them. It's been very clear. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Max. Thank you.
Thank you.